What do we learn about worship from the time of the Great Exile? Hello, this is Good Word. I'm Dave Thomas. Thank you for joining us. We are continuing our discussion of worship. It's proving to be a fascinating subject. This is our 10th week on the subject. We have a few more after this. I'm happy to have my same conversation partners today, Pedrito Maynard Reed and Alden Thompson. Those of you who have been listening have heard some lively interchanges, and I anticipate that perhaps we'll have some again today. Now, if you look into the history of ancient Israel, there is this thing about the Babylonian exile, which is a great dividing point where the whole nation was carried away into Babylon in the time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel. And then some years after that, 7 years, they returned. And there are, in some of these prophetic writings, some glimpses into worship and the dynamics of worship that existed there that we are invited to talk about. And I thought perhaps we would begin with Ezekiel chapter 8, which in many ways is a difficult chapter to read because it describes all kinds of misdoings that were associated with worship that are taking place in the temple.
Before you go to a specific, there is something about Ezekiel that I like to point out. Ezekiel is filled with drama and an acted thing.
Yes.
And I find that our worship in many instances is so stale. It's a sermon, and I love sermons. I'm a preacher. But we sing and we preach and we go away. And there is not enough drama in it. I find in the book of Ezekiel, God enacting things.
Build a model of the city and then break the wall down.
Right. Lie down, you know, and bake on one side. Bake cakes out of cow dung, you know. What if we put more drama into our worship service to get the word of the Lord across? I find Ezekiel to be a good example of drama in worship, and I think it makes the point sometimes more powerful than just speaking the word.
You mean some drama in your-face kind of worship.
And, they'll never forget it.
Any comments on Ezekiel 8, Alden?
Well, I think one of the preliminary comment here, I think, is appropriate to say that God was daring in the sense that He sent his people into captivity. Normally, each nation's God would protect them from this. If God allowed your people to go into captivity, well, your God was weak. But this God was strong. He took his people into captivity and continued to be a strong presence there, especially you see this Nebuchadnezzar. But now Ezekiel, from captivity, he's from Babylon, long ways from home. He looks back and sees this, all these ghastly things happening in the temple at home. Now, I think during the captivity, it was largely the leadership that was taken. You know, there were many people who were left behind, but the people that were left behind, it was not a happy scene at all.
But I put a question down here. Where does the courage to do all this wrong come from? Now, here are these people in Ezekiel 8. They're in the house of God, perpetrating the very things that God had railed against. How do we get to that point?
Oh, you adapt to the customs of the people around you. See, we have that same danger today, especially in America. You know, the critics would say, in Europe, the world ignores the church. In America, all you need to do is slap the name of Jesus on it, and it's fine. It's now religious. So they found pagan cultures very attractive. Again and again and again, even while they still had kings, they would go away. And many of their kings went away.
So is this a struggle over being relevant? Because I sometimes wonder about that. You know, I have my own struggles with relevancy because relevancy seems to be so faddish. You know, and I think there's a great danger in trying to always be relevant because you end up just following whatever fad comes. Is that what we see here?
But you see, it's not a matter of relevance because I find the Psalms to be relevant. I find change to be relevant. I find when you scratch where it's itch to be relevant. The problem is when God is not at the center. And what was happening is that God was not at the center of these practices.
Yes, that's true.
When you took God out of the center, So it's not the songs you sing. It's not the drama you do. It's not the preaching you do. It's not whether you
keep making this point, Pinrito, like we need to get it, huh?
It's when you put God and say, now he's center at the thing. That makes the difference between it of the world, it being pagan, and it be Christocentric, it being Christian.
Because you realize what you're saying, that you could take a pagan practice and use it to worship God.
There are lots of pagan practices that we have done, that we use. That there are lots of them, things that we do, that are of the world, but we have baptized them and made Jesus the center. Mm. Even Luther said, the devil don't have the right to all the good music.
Well, one of the surprising things, you see, God very carefully...
That's a Jamaican version of that, but that's okay.
For instance, it is a real surprise when you discover that the sanctuary in Israel is the same basic pattern as the Canaanite sanctuaries. Mm-hmm. Mm. So in other words, if you want to worship, you want to have a building that others will recognize what it is.
Yeah. But you have different meanings.
Sure. And even the Psalms, for instance, Psalm 29, I think, is one psalm where virtually every single phrase in it can be paralleled with Psalms of Baal. Mm. It's as if they come in.
Yeah.
They come in and say, you think Baal is big and strong and tough? We can sing that song better.
Mm-hmm.
Ta-da, and you tuck in Yahweh's name. Yeah, yeah. Yahweh's name. So yeah. Yahweh is big and strong. So the Lord is always building bridges.
Yeah,
he
does.
I remember back in the early 70s, the preacher, the pastor of the college church said to me, Pedrito, you can't be playing one of my favorite songs for offertory, London Dare Ear. He says, you can't play that. That's a worldly song. The kids are singing O Danny Boy to it. You know, and
now there's a great hymn to that tune.
Now it's right now in the hymnal, in our present day hymnal. Yeah.
It's one of my favorite hymns because it juxtaposes what I cannot know with what I do.
That's
know.
Exactly right. Yeah. So you take the hymn that was used very much for the world, and you now put Christ at the center of that. They were not putting Christ, God, at the center of their worship in the temple.
So that creates a bridge to Daniel 3. Which is the chapter in which tells the well-known story of Nebuchadnezzar rebelling against the vision of chapter 2 is the way I would describe that.
Mm-hmm.
What can we learn from this here? I'm particularly intrigued by the fact that Nebuchadnezzar required everybody in his kingdom to come and join him in his rewriting of divine history. Any comments on this chapter?
Well, that's a classic example of only a partial conversion.
Why do you think he required everybody to join him? That's the part that interests me. I mean, is it a situation where if you're going to have your neck in the noose, you want as many necks in there with yours, or what's?
Well, I don't think Nebuchadnezzar really tumbled to the idea of monotheism being one God. I mean, he was quite willing for a period to, you know, we'll add Israel's God here. But even there, it's so striking when you look at the different stories. I was always brought up on the Daniel model. You know, open your windows towards Jerusalem, or the three friends standing, you know. But there is also the Esther model, where Esther didn't say a squeak until it came right down to the last minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she admitted who she was. See,
you cannot, in the Bible is diverse, which is one of the emphasis I like to make when I talk about worship. There is just not one way. There is this way where you stand up, and there's another way where you work through subtlety.
Yeah.
Right? And this is one of the ways. And I'm very happy for that he stood up against Nebuchadnezzar. These boys stood up against Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah. We're going to worship the only true God when it was pushing for that.
Yeah. I guess my it's a perverse fascination is that why does Nebuchadnezzar, I understand why he creates a golden image. He doesn't like the history that he learned in the divine vision, and so he wants to project a new history. But what is it about people who want to be rebels against God who must bring others to join them? And in this case, he required them on pain of death. Come and join me in my rewriting of history, which to me is kind of amazing.
But don't Christians do that? I'm throwing that out as a question.
Yeah. No, I'm saying that all humans seem to do that.
When
we're doing wrong, we don't want to do it by ourselves. We want people, and if we have power over people, we want them to knuckle under.
They think that they're doing right.
Mm,
well, I think that the power of our community around us is very important. Now, on the positive side, I like Hebrews chapter 10, where it says, "Let us therefore hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who has promised is faithful. Mm-hmm. And let us consider how to provoke one another to love and good deeds, not neglecting to meet together, mm-hmm. as is the habit mm-hmm. of some." Mm-hmm. Now, the flip side, C.S. Lewis says he finds that the society of unbelievers makes faith harder, even when there are people on whose opinions on any other subject are known to be worthless. So you're surrounded by people, and if you're in mischief, you don't want the good guys there.
Yeah.
You want to bring them in so you can all do this nasty stuff together. So,
yeah.
So it works both ways. That's one reason why we ought to pick our friends carefully.
Yeah, and why we ought to gather for worship.
That's right.
Val, yes.
Let me ask you about Haggai 1. Interesting here that he critiques the people or criticizes them for building their own houses and living in lined houses while the temple suffered. Any thoughts on that one?
Again, it's not putting God first.
Yeah.
If this is not saying that we must build fancy temples or anything. That's not what it is. What do you put first? Where are your priorities?
Yeah. And they had settled themselves before settling the things.
That's exactly. It's
there. Well, and there was good reason for this. I mean, if you go back to Ezra, for example, when they first come back, they lay the foundation. Now, if you'd seen the previous temple, this is a puny little thing.
Yeah. So,
but if you'd never seen any temple at all, and so Ezra chapter 3 closes, and there was a great noise. Some people were crying their hearts out. Some were singing great joy.
Yeah.
But they allowed themselves to be discouraged.
Yeah.
It was another 15 years before they got around again to putting anything on top of that foundation. So let's build our houses. Nothing we can do. And Haggai puts the needle in.
Yeah. I was interested in Zechariah's comment about your fathers, where are they? In other words, in post-exilic Israel, come back here and the ways of their fathers, if they follow them, will lead them to nothing. But maybe in the last minute here, we could have a little commentary on Nehemiah 1, where you have one of the great prayers of the Bible. And I know we haven't yet had a chance to talk about prayer as an element of worship, but any comments about Nehemiah and his prodding people to worship and his own personal experience in worship?
Well, Nehemiah is so famous for being tough as nails, and it was just amazing. By the time when he got back to Jerusalem after this prayer, he went to work. And in 52 days, I think it was, he had the walls rebuilt. They hadn't built it in 100 years.
Yeah.
But, boy, 52 days, and his detractors come, "Hey, we want to talk with you." "I'm not going to come down and talk with you. I'm doing a great work."
So, that's a great verse, by the way. It should be used strategically.
Oh, Mama taught us, be the Nehemiahs. I'm doing a good work, great work. I'm not coming down. Nothing is going to stop me. God has to be first and center.
Well, gentlemen, thank you. We bring our discussion to a conclusion with a word of thanks to you and also to Chad Ofterhaar, our engineer. And thanks, my thanks to you, our listeners, for Good Word. I'm Dave Thomas.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.